Welcome to Trinity Forum Conversations. I'm Cherie Harder, the president of the Trinity Forum, and with me today is New York Times columnist and author Ross Douthat. Before joining the New York Times as an op-ed columnist in 2009, Ross served as the senior editor at The Atlantic and blogger for TheAtlantic.com. He's also a film critic for National Review, the author of several books, including Privilege, Harvard and Education of the Ruling Class, and Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. His latest book, Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics, is being published today by the Free Press and has already generated a great deal of discussion, as well as no small amount of controversy. We're delighted to welcome Ross to the Trinity Forum to discuss his latest work. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, the topic of heresy is not one that you would necessarily expect a New York Times columnist to tackle. What made you decide to write this book?
Well, the idea for the book, I think, originally came to me late in the Bush presidency, somewhere in the sort of 2006 to 2008 window, when the conversation about religion in America was dominated by debates over the existence of God. And these were particularly the debates that were sort of started by the new atheists, figures like, you know, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, and so on. And then their arguments were met by rebuttals from believers and so on, and you had sort of this round robin of debate. And I thought it was obviously a fascinating debate. The debate over the existence of God is a very interesting and extremely important one. But I also thought that the sort of binaries it set up, where, you know, it created an image of America's religious culture as sort of divided sort of starkly between religion and secularism, Christianity and atheism, God and not God. And that, I felt that, you know, while those divisions were real, they were also missing a big part of the story of religion in America, which, as I say in the book, you know, takes place in the parts of the country that are reading neither Christopher Hitchens nor, say, the Pope's latest encyclical. And so this is a book about, or at least it tries to be about, sort of American religion as it actually exists, you know, to some extent within the culture war, and I do talk a great deal about politics and so on. But I also spend a lot of time focusing on, you know, what's often dismissed as sort of pop theology, pop spirituality, figures ranging from Joel Osteen to Elizabeth Gilbert in Eat, Pray, Love to Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. Because I think that, you know, those are the places where, and the authors from whom many Americans, in some sense, get their religious views. And the subtitle of the book, with its extremely loaded word, heretics, is intended to be, I mean, obviously it is critical in the sense that I, you know, am a Catholic who thinks of myself as sort of someone who tries to be a small O Orthodox Christian. And so I'm, you know, by labeling sort of systems of religious thought heresies, I'm obviously setting myself up to sort of argue with them and criticize them. But I also think that it is actually the right word to use to describe the state of religion in America. I think we live in a culture that is no longer, let's say, less traditionally Christian than it used to be, in which institutional Christian churches, both Catholic and Protestant, are weaker than they were in previous eras in our country's history. But at the same time, I don't think the country has drifted far away enough from sort of Christian influences to be described as meaningfully post-Christian or, you know, pagan, as some more pessimistic Christians like to say. And certainly, it shouldn't be described as secular. I think, you know, by certain measurements, Americans are more religious than they've ever been. Certainly they're as fascinated by spiritual issues, religious questions, miracles, you know, the personality of Jesus of Nazareth as ever. So I think, you know, the word heresy exists in the Christian tradition to describe forms of Christian practice and belief that depart significantly from sort of the Christian core of, you know, the Nicene Creed, the four Gospels, and so on, but are still sufficiently either influenced by Christianity or make a claim to be Christian, to represent often themselves the truest form of Christianity. And so it's not useful to think of them as sort of different religious traditions altogether. So that's sort of the both the roots of the book and the roots of the subtitle.
In many ways, what you describe in the first part of the book is an anomaly, at least compared to the rest of the world, in that you describe the erosion of traditional institutions of Christianity. But at the same time, you assert, and I think there's good evidence to believe, that the religious impulse is as strong as ever, which, of course, is in contrast to what we've seen happen in Europe. What is it about America that has made us exceptional in that area?
Well, I'm skeptical that the religious impulse is actually that much weaker in Europe than in the United States. I'm a sort of secularization skeptic writ large. I think that the religious impulse is deeply rooted enough in human nature that it's going to manifest itself even in what can seem superficially like the most secular of human societies. And I think if you look at polling data from Europe, and don't just stop with sort of top line, do you identify with Christianity or not? Do you believe in the Judeo-Christian God or not? But drill down into questions like, you know, into sort of questions that get at whether Europeans are genuinely secular or are sort of still fascinated by spiritual issues, you know, believe in sort of supernatural forces. I mean, you know, even something as superstitious as, you know, astrology, tarot cards, all of these things, I think reflect the working out of the religious impulse. And I think that Europe, in that sense, is maybe a little less secular than a lot of observers, and particularly Americans, assume it to be. I think one of the big differences between Europe and the United States is precisely because we don't have a tradition of having a single established church. Americans have always been more comfortable sort of with a kind of do-it-yourself approach to religion in general, Christianity in particular. So some of the trends I'm talking about in the book have always been with us, going back to the founding generation and before. And so I feel like in a lot of European cultures, particularly Catholic but Protestant as well, there's a sort of either-or. You know, you either identify with whatever, you know, if you're Italian, you identify with the church or you identify against the church. And there's less room for sort of the kind of identification with religion but not with a specific institutional church that I think defines much of the American religious experience today. So it's that there's always been more space for that form of expression in the United States. And so the decline of institutional religion has left Americans are, in the wake of that decline, Americans are more comfortable still explicitly calling themselves religious than Europeans who think of things in a more you're for the established church or you're not binary might be inclined to do.
And
but
why,
this is just a theory.
And why has institutionalized religion in America declined so rapidly?
Well, there are, you know, many, many, many reasons. But like any good author, I try to distill them down to a nice bullet-pointed list of four. And the four trends that I focus on in the chapters on the sort of weakening of the institutional churches, particularly in the 1960s and 1970s, but continuing to the present day. The first factor that I identify is political polarization and the extent to which Christianity, beginning in the 1960s and 1970s on the religious left, and then continuing in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s on the religious right. On both ends of the spectrum, there was an increasing conflation of religious identity with political identity. And that conflation made it easier for Americans who didn't share that political identity, first the sort of association between the religious left and the Democratic Party, and later between the religious right and the Republican Party, to sort of feel alienated from religion more generally. And You see this, I think, today in, you know, opinion polls and sort of the rise of Americans who decline to identify with a religious tradition out of a sense that that identification isn't just a religious statement, but it's a partisan statement as well. So there's more of a feeling than there was 50 years ago that to be Christian is to be Republican, let's say. And that means that people who aren't Republicans are less likely to want to identify as Christians. And I use it, I use the distinction between the careers of, say, Billy Graham and Martin Luther King on the one hand, and, say, a Pat Robertson and Jesse Jackson on the other hand, who are in certain ways sort of parallel figures, sort of powerful evangelists, civil rights activists, and so on. But the way that Graham and King engaged with politics was much more, you know, they were obviously intensely political figures, but they were also figures who were, in Graham's case, are more above the partisan fray. Whereas Jackson, who saw himself as an heir to King, ran for president as a partisan Democrat. And likewise, Robertson did the same thing on the Republican side. And that, I think, is a problem for Christian witness that is more acute than it's been in the past. The second factor is the one that everyone talks about, the sexual revolution. And everyone talks about it for a reason. I think that the sort of the striking challenge that those social changes pose to traditional Christian sexual ethics are challenges that no Christian body has been completely able to confront and resolve. And the sexual revolution made the Christian sexual ethic seem less commonsensical than it had seemed in the past, and this led to a falling away from institutional expressions of Christianity more generally. The third factor that I cite is the impact of globalization and decolonization. Decolonization, particularly obviously in the 60s and 70s, but the extent to which Americans in that era increasingly, thanks to, you know, television and then of course subsequently the internet and so on, saw the world through a more global lens, I think that, that experience underlies a lot of the trend towards theological relativism that you've seen in America over the last 40 or 50 years, a sense that Christianity is on the one hand sort of associated with a Western European, maybe imperialist and exploitative past that people are less eager to be associated with, and two, just the sense that the world is a much bigger place maybe than, you know, it seemed pre-television. And in, you know, the bigger the world gets, the harder it is for, I think, a lot of Americans to believe that, you know, their particular religious tradition could be the one true religious tradition. And that doesn't make them less religious, but again, it makes them less identified with a specific tradition. Of course, what's fascinating is that over the same period, the people who were decolonizing the, you know, third world, Africans, Asians, and so on, actually became more receptive to institutional Christianity than they had been in the past. So there was this fascinating, you know, divergence in the experience of the colonizers and the colonized. And then the final factor that I talk about is the impact of mass affluence, which I think is often underplayed, particularly by conservative Christians who are, you know, for good reasons, I think, overall, very favorably disposed towards capitalism and economic growth and so on. But they sometimes tend to downplay the extent to which riches alone are, you know, it's a challenge for a religious faith that places such a strong emphasis on a suspicion of worldly wealth and a suspicion of the temptations associated with worldliness and so on. And I think the difference between the experience of the generation that came of age during the Depression and World War II and had that sort of very visceral experience of having the economic rug pulled out from under them and having, you know, experiencing privation and want, their relationship to Christianity was very different than the relationship of their children who came of age in this sort of cornucopia of post-war abundance. And that abundance made a religion, you know, rooted in skepticism about sort of you know, that kind, that level of wealth. It just made it not that easy a fit, I think. And more specifically, if you look at just something like the priesthood in Catholicism and the ministry for Protestants, just the mere fact that the wealth available to a professional who became a lawyer or a doctor or an investment banker or something went up by so much from 1950 to the present, whereas the mix of, you know, wealth and prestige available to somebody who became certainly a Catholic priest but also a, you know, a minister in a traditional Protestant denomination, it did not increase by a similar amount. And as much as we like to think and want to believe that people enter the ministry for purely selfless reasons, clearly the that selflessness became a harder thing to contemplate when the alternative seemed to promise such higher levels of affluence.
The last few years have not necessarily been great ones for institutionalized religion in the United States, the Catholic Church and the sex scandal there being perhaps the most obvious example. Why is it that you believe institutionalization itself is so necessary for the preservation of Orthodox Christianity? And then related to that, institutionalization, of course, carries with it its own power politics.
Right.
One man's heretic is another man's reformer. Martin Luther, of course, was considered a heretic at the time. So what would you say to
occasionally
those?
Still is, but no, this is a very ecumenical book, and I wouldn't dream of going there.
Of course. What would you say to those who would point out historically the role that reformers have actually made in preserving the health of
I think there's, you know, the sort of ongoing debates over the Protestant Reformation aside, there's absolutely no question that sort of reform as well as pure obedience has been crucial to Christian vitality across the last 2,000 years. And nothing in my endorsement of a more vigorous institutional faith should be taken to suggest that institutions don't need reformers. In fact, institutions depend on reformers. But they depend on reformers who are invested in the institutions that they're trying to reform, and who are invested, too, in either sort of reforming that institution from within, or if they have to break with the institution and found a new one, in founding something that can be passed down after their own sort of personal charism has ended, as all charisms do with death. And this is, I mean, obviously I bring a Catholic perspective to these things, and, you know, Catholics have a particular investment in a sort of institutional view of Christianity because we regard it as one of the great strengths of our church, lo these, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. But I think that it is a place where contemporary evangelicalism does need to sort of think hard about the future that it is making for Protestant Christianity in the United States, because they're, you know, evangelicalism. I went to a big evangelical event recently, and they sent around a list of how people were affiliated and identified, and a huge proportion of people were identified as non-denominational. And that non-denominational spirit has, in a way, been one of the great strengths of evangelical Christianity since the Billy Graham era, right? It's helped evangelicalism escape from these sort of endless blood feuds that, you know, that divided Protestants during the fundamentalist modernist era. But it's hard to leave a kind of intergenerational inheritance if you don't have some kind of institution that can be, you know, that can endure from generation to generation. And when you look across the evangelical landscape, I think there's a heavy, heavy emphasis on sort of individual personality and sort of superstar pastors and so on. And that can be a source of great vitality and zeal that, you know, can put my own Catholic Church to shame. But it can also lead to a scenario where you sort of burn brightly and then burn out. And that, I think, is a particular sort of Protestant challenge at the moment, is sort of figuring out, well, what are, you know, can we really have a non-denominational American Christianity that lasts beyond, you know, the generation that practices it? And I think I'm doubtful that the answer is yes. I think in the end, you know, the church is an institution, and whatever form you think that institution should take, it has to take some form in order to be faithful to what I think is the pretty clear message of the Gospels about sort of how Christianity is to be sustained and passed on.
In the second half of your book, you've identified four distinct heresies, you call them, that have basically waxed as the institutional church has waned. The first one you describe as sort of an effort led largely by academics, but joined by some popularizers as well, to refashion or even rediscover Jesus. And I thought the combination of unusual bedfellows that you fingered for this was quite interesting. Everyone from Harvey Cox to Dan Brown,
right,
working in unison. Generally not people you associate together. In what sense do you believe that these unusual bedfellows have sort of united in advancing this heresy?
Well, I think that is the chapter. So, as you say, the second half of the book is focused on sort of specific heresies. That's the chapter where the heresy I'm talking about maybe has sort of less perfect theological coherence. And I think that the real Jesus project, as I call it, is its influence has been primarily sort of destabilizing. It's sort of the destabilization that underlies other heretical experiments and sort of makes them thrive. Because it creates this sort of broad sense that the narrative, the New Testament narrative, the character of Jesus, that all of these things are completely up for grabs, sort of waiting to be refashioned to fit. You know, in the case of Dan Brown, it's sort of a Jesus who is a thoroughly modern kind of Messiah, right? Who, you know, I like to joke he has a wife and a house in the Galilean suburbs, and you know, it just isn't quite what Brown is saying. But what's striking about that project, I think, is that if you read a succession of these authors, ranging from the scholarly to the popular, every one of them has a slightly different view of who the real Jesus was. So it isn't quite that they're sort of painting a coherent portrait. It's more that they're giving theological license to and historical license to religious Americans as a whole to sort of perform their own similar, let's say, cut-and-paste routines with the New Testament. I start that chapter by talking about Thomas Jefferson and the Jefferson Bible, which in a way was sort of the original American real Jesus experiment, where Jefferson thought that he could just, you know, it was clear what in the Bible, what in the New Testament was really Jesus and what had been added later. And the stuff that was really Jesus was the stuff Thomas Jefferson agreed with, and the other stuff he could just carve right out.
Funny how that works.
And funny, right, and that mentality, I think, has defined, again, both the scholarly and the popular side of that project. And I think it's empowered the wide range of voices that I then consider in subsequent chapters, ranging from prosperity preachers, sort of Joel Osteen-type figures who are sort of thought of as more on the political right. I mean, they're not particularly political, but that's sort of a more sort of right-associated heresy, you might say, to sort of the therapeutic religiosity that you get from, like, an Oprah Winfrey, Elizabeth Gilbert, the author of Eat, Pray, Love, and so on, which is, again, more sort of left-oriented heresy. But I think both of them have benefited in part from the cultural sense that the identity of Jesus is up for grabs, and that you can take the character of Jesus and sort of take out the parts that you don't, you know, that challenge you a little too much. So a Republican can sort of, you know, you just cut out the parts about, you know, wealth and so on. And a cultural liberal can say, well, we don't have to look at the parts about sort of sex and divorce and so on. And that, I think, is the root of a lot of, you know, what's going on in the religious landscape today.
Speaking of those other heresies, the second one that you point out is the prosperity theology, the idea that you can name it and claim it or it and grab it. But, of course, you know, this idea of sort of you can think and grow rich and have religious justification for doing so thrived in the mid-20th century as well with Norman Vincent Peale.
Absolutely.
What is it about the last few years that you think has really made this particular distortion of Orthodox Christianity thrive?
Well, I mean, that's a good example of what one of the points I would want to impress on your listeners, which is that I'm not arguing that rampant heresy is a new thing in American life. As you say, you can find, you know, prosperity preachers of all stripes going back into the 19th century, and, you know, Alexis de Tocqueville has, you know, it's talking about them in the 1840s and so on. What's distinctive about our era is the weakness of the Orthodox response, and also in that chapter, the extent to which more Orthodox Christians have just, again, because of the material abundance that we talked about earlier, have sort of allowed allowed certain elements of prosperity theology, I think, to sort of creep under the tent a little bit. And, I mean, these are, you know, I think you see this in, you know, parts of American evangelicalism that would explicitly reject the sort of name it and claim it idea, but are still intensely invested in what one of the authors I quote calls the more money, more ministry approach to Christian witness, which, again, is not, that's not a, I don't want to say that that's a heresy, right? Because obviously more money can lead to more ministry. But all I'm saying is that it can be theologically dangerous because more money can then become an end unto itself. And I think something similar has happened in my own Catholic Church, where you had a generation of Catholic writers who rightly, I think, sort of broke with the idea that Christians should be socialists and, you know, we, you know, needed to reject capitalism and all its works, and rightly argued that Christians could not only be capitalists in good conscience, but probably should support capitalism as the economic system that was, you know, best suited to man's nature. But again, from that idea, it's easy to just tiptoe a little bit further, and suddenly you lose that New Testament skepticism about what the rich person underwriting your, you know, ministry has had to do to earn the money he's spending. You know, I think that's so that's sort of the prosperity gospel chapter is partially about what I think is an explicit heresy, the idea that, yeah, God just wants you to get rich, and if you aren't rich, it's because you haven't prayed hard enough. But it's also about how, what's distinctive about our era, how that heresy has influenced the rest of Christianity as well.
The third heresy you point out seems in many ways closely related to the second, to the baptizing of one's own impulses with religious language and blessing to justify it. And it's this particular heresy that it will be interesting to see if it sort of arouses the most controversy, in that by implication, you name Oprah Winfrey as a heretic. Tell us a little bit more about this third heresy.
Well, so if the prosperity gospel is about, let's say, that God is your stockbroker, right, then what I call the God within in that chapter, it's more the idea that God might be your shrink, right, that, or that God might be your life coach, that one, that sort of God is there primarily to make you feel good about yourself and less to sort of call you to repentance and aware of your own sinfulness, but also that it's this idea that sort of your identity and the divine identity overlap in a profound way, and that your truest self is the truest expression of God himself, or herself, probably some of the authors would say. And again, as with most sort of heretical ideas, this is an idea that is not completely detached from from traditional Christian beliefs and sort of traditional Christian approaches to mysticism and so on. But what it loses sight of, I think, is just the possibility, the strong possibility of that, you know, original sin has a warping effect on your ability to discern God within you. And it makes it easier to assume that whatever sort of impulses you're having are proceeding from the God within, from God himself, rather than proceeding from your libido or your ego, you know, or some other sinful part of yourself. So in a way, one way to look at it is that the prosperity gospel is a theology that's sort of pitched to the needs and anxieties and concerns of sort of the upwardly mobile American working class, right? People who have jobs, you know, who work hard, but are sort of financially insecure and theologically insecure about sort of, you know, whether all of their striving and focusing on financial self-improvement and so on is really consonant with God's plan. And then the God within is more a theology for the upper middle class, people who are a little bit more materially secure and are less likely to worry about whether God's going to help them buy that new house. What they're looking for is not wealth necessarily, but contentment. And that is what this sort of therapeutic religion promises to supply. And obviously, Christianity itself promises to supply contentment as well. So again, it's not you know, it's not completely detached from its roots in Christian faith.
The final heresy you discuss is one of excessive nationalism, the idea of fusing religion and politics so completely that they come to really identify with each other. Where do you draw the line between a healthy and robust patriotism and the heresy of nationalism?
It can be a hard line to draw, but I think one useful way to think about it is that is to look at the language of Lincoln's second inaugural address, right? This is a speech, in a way, that's sort of drenched in religious language and drenched as well in a kind of providentialist reading of American history, right, in which the Civil War itself is, in some mysterious sense, God's will and sort of a working out of America's, you know, of the original sin of slavery and so on. But I think the attitude that Lincoln brings to that providentialist reading of history, and Lincoln himself, I should say, was not really an Orthodox Christian in any classic sense, but I think the second inaugural address is it reflects a healthy Christian patriotism. It reflects, on the one hand, a sense that God works out his purposes in history. God may have a special plan in mind for the United States, and it's entirely appropriate to look for God's will in the working out of real-world events and political causes and so on. But at the same time, there is a deep humility in that address about our ability to really understand God's purposes, and a deep sense that that our national story may not be the working out of the kingdom of heaven on earth, right? That America may be a nation like other nations that's liable to, you know, to chastisement as well as blessing and so on. And where I think patriotism shades into the heresy of nationalism, I think it can happen. I argue that there's sort of a messianic side to this and an apocalyptic side. And the messianic side sort of conflates your nation, America, with sort of the future New Jerusalem, and basically suggests that the role of American Christians is to sort of gradually transform America into a kind of kingdom of heaven on earth. And I think this is sort of the characteristic temptation of liberal Christianity, and it's what you get a lot of in the progressive era. It's where the sort of social gospel message can you know, shade into something hubristic. It's, I think, one of the deep flaws in, say, Woodrow Wilson's worldview and so on. But then the other temptation is a more conservative one, and that temptation sort of assumes that America was a chosen nation at some point in the past, right? That it identifies America with not by analogy with Israel, but more directly as a literal new Israel that literally was, in some sense founded by God, and that everything since that founding, and this is, I talk a lot about Glenn Beck in this chapter because I think this is the sort of the heresy of Glenn Beck, that the founding was this kind of covenantal moment with God, and that we have violated this covenant and that therefore we're in the exact same position as, say, the rebellious Israelites in the Old Testament. And I think that, you know, again, it can be a fine line to draw, but the contrast I make is between Lincoln's line about America being an almost chosen people, right, where there is this analogy to Israel or an analogy to the church, but not a direct identification, versus the sense on both the right and the left that either we were really a chosen people at some sense, or we can at some point, or we can become one, you know, through our you know, yes, we can, hope and change exertions, right? I mean, I think the Obama campaign in 2008 was really a sort of classic expression of the sort of messianic liberalism and the delusions that can be associated with that. Right. Yeah, so I'll leave it there.
Your book is descriptive rather than prescriptive. You've made a very compelling and often colorful case that institutionalized religion in America is on the decline, and heresies have filled that void. You don't provide necessarily a
five-point plan, a five-year plan, perhaps.
But at the end, you say you remain hopeful. why, as a cultural critic and a Christian, do you remain hopeful?
Well, so the book starts with the post-World War II revival and this period that was, relatively speaking, a kind of high point in the institutional strength for the various Christian churches. I think a high point intellectually in many ways, and figures ranging from Reinhold Niebuhr to Thomas Merton and so on, and also a political high point when I think Christian political engagement through the civil rights movement found one of its most effective and, you know, appropriate expressions, let's say. But one of the points, I start with that era not necessarily to argue, you know, 1957 was the golden age to end all golden ages, but the point I'm trying to make is that that was a world where a more vital, robust institutional Christianity had sort of been rebuilt, right? Because if you flash back further in time to the 1920s and 1930s, you know, Catholicism is still sort of in the immigrant ghetto. Protestantism is just riven by the fundamentalist modernist wars. And there's this sense across the board, not only in the U.S. but in Western Europe, that the future belongs to socialism or communism or fascism or Nazism, right? To these sort of totalizing secular ideologies. And then comes the Depression and the World War, and sort of the horrors of totalitarianism on the right and the left are laid bare. And you have a moment when, you know, both at the mass level and at the elite level, there is a sort of, people are willing to look again at Christian orthodoxy and have an opportunity to rebuild some of these, what had been weakened institutions. So that experience and other experiences like it in the American past is part of what gives me hope that, you know, something similar could be accomplished in the future. Now, it is a more pessimistic than optimistic book, because I think that the sort of undoing of institutional Christianity is further advanced today than it was, let's say, in 1927. And I think that sort of the overall drift in American culture is away from sort of institutionalized everything, right? You know, what we see in Christianity, we also see in, you know, sort of how people feel about the government, you know, their willingness to sort of join community organizations, the decline of, you know, the family itself, the most basic institution of society. So there's sort of this across-the-board trend that is, you know, interacts with the religious trend and affects it and so on, that I think is grounds for a little bit of a deeper pessimism. But obviously, you know, I mean, Christians are sort of called to be optimistic in general. Even though the book, as I say, I think it's written in a spirit of pessimism, it's important to sort of, you know, have hope and think about possibilities for the future and so on. I have one of the lines I'm a little proud of is when I say something like, you know, Christianity has always depended on unexpected resurrections, right? And I think that's the spirit that Christians need to bring to bear in what can seem like a very sort of a difficult moment for traditional faith in the United States.
Thanks, Ross. We're glad to have you join us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to an interview with Ross Douthat, columnist and author of Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics, on the decline of Orthodox Christianity in America and the rise of various heresies to fill the vacuum and the resulting public consequences. I'm Cherie Harder, and this has been a Trinity Forum Conversation. For more exclusive interviews with other thought leaders, please visit our website at www.ttf.org. Thank you for joining us.